Good evening. Today is Thursday, May 13th, 2010. Welcome to the Solari Report. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Two things before we get going. I want to apologize for my Lauren Bacall voice. I seem to have caught something. I feel great, but I sound a little different. So please bear with me. And also, this week as I was preparing for the Solari Report, which I literally do every day because I'm watching, collecting, thinking about what we're going to talk about, I just wanted to say thank you again for the opportunity to do this. It is such a joy to have as your work, working in service of people who you like and doing something that you love. And it's an incredible blessing for me. I love the people I get to talk to. We get great questions. I love sort of dialoguing with you by email. And I just want to say thank you because it's a blessing to me. It's a blessing to the whole Solari team. And we love doing it. So tonight, money and markets. A few questions, mostly, most of them I want to put to Franklin during the precious metals report. I wasn't planning on doing a movie tonight, but I changed the blog post yesterday and want to include the very brief YouTube video of two gentlemen from C.W. Roberts Construction Company in Tallahassee. I paraphrased the video as good old boy permaculture, and what they're doing is doing a proposal on how they can help clean up the oil spill, and we'll talk about it later. Tonight in Money and Markets, I want to talk about three stories. First is the spill in the Gulf that is approaching land this weekend. It's expected sometime this weekend to begin to touch one of the outer tips of Louisiana. I want to talk about Greece. We got a wonderful sort of what's happening in Greece, what's happening in lots of countries that have experienced what Greece is experiencing or, according to the news, are expected, and whether or not it can happen to us here and what it means to us here. And included in that, I want to mention what's going on in California. And then the third is enforcement. There's clearly a shift in enforcement and actions between Wall Street and Washington, and I'd like to touch on that. The Gulf oil spill, quite an amazing story. We don't know what the facts are. Sometimes when something important happens, you'll see me get very quiet and read and study, hoping that enough signals will emerge to tell us what's going on. Sometimes it can take quite a long time. I don't think we begin to have even a small percentage of the facts of what's happened and why it's happening and what it means. What we do know is that the engineers on site have not yet been successful at capping up the leakage from the basement of from the bottom of the ocean, and that the amount of oil pumping into the ocean is quite an ecological disaster. If the solutions that the engineers have been working on don't work, we run the possibility that it could be literally months before the oil stops spilling into the ocean. What this means is that oil will reach and pollute the coastal line of Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, and even beyond. And even if you believe that the oil can be cleaned up, the economic impact to states that have already been ravaged by Katrina and other hurricanes, as well as the recession, and are this summer facing significant state and local cutbacks, the combined 1-2 punch of the recession plus state and local cutbacks, as well as the impact of businesses on the coastal regions, will be absolutely devastating. And so my concern is that this spill is going to have far more ramifications both for the South, the country, and for you and me economically than we begin to understand. The Pew Foundation just released a new study today saying that the majority of people think that this is an ecological disaster, but it can be cleaned up. The challenge is if it takes a year to clean it up, you can't imagine how many businesses, particularly small businesses, will go under. Fishermen, farmers, tourism is a huge issue. Property values and the real estate and other ancillary businesses that work around the housing and property values. So we're talking about something which could be quite devastating. I put up earlier this week two videos on the blog. One is a video done by two gentlemen, I believe from Louisiana, who simply went out and flew over the spill and noted how really, you know, you would expect a massive cleanup operation to be underway. What was really underway was rather thin and sporadic, given the size of the spill. The other video is a video by the hero of these weeks, of this week, the two gentlemen from C.W. Roberts Construction in Tallahassee, Florida, who are proposing a very permaculture-like solution. In the video, they take two bowls of water, they pour oil into the water, they put hay into the oil plus water, swirl it around, pull it out, and almost all the oil comes out with the hay. And what they're saying is, hey, why don't we just get a bunch of hay, go out, and just start cleaning up the oil spill to the extent we can. It's remarkably charming. And you realize watching the first video with relatively few people out there, what you realize is, wait a minute, we've got thousands of fishermen and farmers and unemployed people along these coastal regions who are worried to death about the land and the ocean and the bays that they love. Why not engage them in something equivalent to an environmental Dunkirk evacuation and get on out there and create, you know, a serious economic activity for all of them, cleaning this thing up? One of the things proposed is bringing the hay back and using it as fuel. Makes perfect sense to me. I sent it to a bunch of chemical and other engineers I know and people I know who live along the coastal region and say, could this possibly work? And they wrote back and said, oh, yeah. So why you have a few representatives of the highly centralized system out there on the oil spill by themselves, and you don't have this entire armada of people sitting on the coast scared to death and who need work, why the two somehow haven't come together is something I can't fathom. And I just have a picture of a group of politicians and corporate leaders sitting around scared to death, worried they're going to be blamed, who've been frightened by their attorneys. And you wonder where the leadership is going to come. So up on the blog, I wrote a letter to the three governors of five states, encouraging them to just get on about the business of the oil spill, not wait for the U.S. government and BP. And one of the things I proposed, because obviously they are staring huge deficits and cutbacks in the face, I suggested they all start a state bank and print their own currency to pay for it, if the governments will accept that currency or script as valid payment for taxes and licenses and fees, it should go. And lest you think that's a far-fetched proposal, I put up a link to one of Sam Smith, the Progressive Review's description of Guernsey Island doing something like that. So it's not far-fetched at all. There is a way to make this work economically. And to think that spill is coming towards the Gulf region in a way that will devastate the economy, it's crazy not to try. So I leave that all up there for your perusal. But make no mistake about it, the 1-2 economic punch of this spill on top of the state and local cutbacks and the recession is going to have a devastating impact on those southern states, and it's going to reverberate back to every one of us, not just in America, but the global economy. Greece, we got a wonderful question from one of you, and it says, it's titled Labor People Uprising in Greece and What That Means to Our Standard of Living. Instead of focusing on gold rising because people being sketchy about the Euro-Greece bailout, please talk about the implications of the austerity program trying to be implemented in Greece, as has been done in Lithuania and Latvia, on the people in those countries, and what it will mean to our standard of living. Well, this is the perfect thing, perfect question, very, very insightful question. What we're watching in Greece is a replay of a process we've seen, and it's one of the reasons I've asked every subscriber to watch the Sir James Goldsmith interview with Charlie Rose that's up on the blog. In 1994, Sir James Goldsmith explains that what is being instituted with globalization and the Uruguay round of GATT, the General Agreement on Tariff and Trade, is a fundamental shifting in the relationship between labor and capital that will be absolutely devastating both to the first world countries and the emerging to labor in the emerging markets. Everything he says is spot on, and it's all coming true. Lest you think it was just Sir James Goldsmith, I put also up on the blog about a week and a half ago the video of Ross Perot in the 1992 presidential debates talking about the giant sucking sound of jobs going to Mexico. In earlier Solari reports, I've talked about Naomi Klein's wonderful book, The Shock Doctrine, where you go into a country, you institute, quote-unquote, reforms. Those reforms fundamentally steal huge amount of resources and wealth from the broad group of people, centralizing control, centralizing wealth. I've talked about it in Latin America. Anne Williamson has written very powerfully about it in Russia. If you read my article, Financial Coup d'Etat or Myth of the Rule of Law, I explain this process of what is going on throughout the 90s and throughout the 2000s. It's been going 20 years since we instituted the WTO. We're now beginning to see it happen in the first world countries, and it starts with Greece and some of the other countries in Europe. What is being done to Greece is a centralization of wealth, and it comes about, and there are hundreds of recipes. It's like the joy of cooking. But what you've seen is a pump and dumping of the economy where you bring in lots of banks bring in lots of cheap and easy loans, including to government. The government does a whole lot of things which don't increase wealth or infrastructure or fundamental economics in that place, but they create a whole lot of profit for big companies, particularly outside of the country. It's a little bit like our defense budget. Or big, big fees for insiders, lobbyists, politicians. And so you get a whole sort of class of oligarchy is what they call them in Russia. So the oligarchs make a lot of money. The banks make a lot of money, but this really doesn't benefit the people. At the same time, the country is awash in liquidity, same as we were with the housing bubble. Once the bubble bursts, though, it's time to consolidate control. And so you're watching a fundamental shift between labor and capital and the value thereof, and it's being instituted by criminal means. A lot of that debt was what I call fraudulently induced. We saw on the bailout list week, and you can see this the article on the blog, one of the things that had the Greek people the most upset was that $2 billion of the bailout money was going to go to buy more weapons from German and French manufacturers. And in fact, if you looked at the bailout package, very little of it was going to Greece. It was going to French and German banks and French and German weapons manufacturing. It's very not unlike what happened with the bailout here. So you're literally watching a corporate and warfare overhead, which has been, and this is why I call it a tapeworm, draining and draining the economy. People have let it go by because it was awash with liquidity that came from more and more debt. Now the debt bubble is over, and the people are being told they're liable for all this debt. And the way that debt is going to be made whole is literally their pensions are going to be stripped. Now, what does that mean to us here? This is the same thing that's being talked about here. If you look at, for example, the Pete Peterson Foundation just had a conference, including with President Obama, and you see President Obama talking about the time has come to put Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid on the table. We can't afford them. So what he's saying, and this is an amazing thing for a president to say coming into his first midterm elections when he's down in the poll. So somebody feels supremely confident that the president can stand up and literally allude to the possibility of cutting Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security in an election year. But in addition, and I'm going to talk about it more with Franklin during Precious Metals, we see Bill Clinton at the same Precious Metals conference, the video's up on the blog, saying, well, you know, we can't keep functioning. We went off the gold standard. We've created all this hot money, and now we've got a financial system that's taking too much out of the middle of the economy, and we need a financial system that goes back to serving the real economy. What is he talking about? He's talking about flipping a switch and going back to a real economy. The question is, who's going to be held responsible for the liabilities? The message of Greece is it's going to be the broad spectrum of people. It's not going to be the insiders. The insiders are being protected. That was the message of the bailout. So Greece has very important messages for all of us. One of the challenges on Greece is we've been watching globally this process of sort of jamming the line between labor and capital happening region by region or country by country. That's becoming politically extremely difficult to do because now the debt hang is so great. If you look at the situation in Europe with the different banks, the Greek banks, the Italian banks, the German banks, the Irish banks, all those banks are very dependent on each other. And so you have a complicated war between the different banks and their dependency on each other and trying to get enough money from the people and cutbacks to make it all go. What I believe Clinton was alluding to was coming up with a solution that comes top-down through the G20, and interestingly enough, the same week that Clinton was floating those trial balloons, we have the Swiss National Bank calling a meeting in Zurich with IMF to talk about, among other things, the SDR system, which is one of the ways that could be done. So instead of it happening in Greece and then this country and that country, as we all sit and get terrified, we wake up tomorrow and we literally have a global solution through a global currency. Finally, I just want to say a few words about enforcement. Last week we talked about the SEC and Department of Justice actions and investigations of Goldman Sachs. Then this weekend, the New York Post runs with a story saying that J.P. Morgan Chase is being investigated for its conduct in the silver market. I thought that was interesting given our article last week about J.P. Morgan Chase's conduct in the silver market on ETF SLV. And then this week, we see an amazing incident. We have a new CEO of Morgan Stanley, Jamie Gorman. He's in Tokyo. And literally this week, the Wall Street Journal, Tuesday night, Wall Street Journal, 5 minutes after midnight Wednesday morning, I think it's Wednesday morning, announces that Morgan Stanley is being investigated by the Department of Justice. Now, for a criminal investigation, which it apparently is, to leak to the Wall Street Journal, a Rupert Murdoch outlet, before informing the institution that it's a target is way outside the bounds of any law. Quite amazing. It shows you the extent of what's going on. All night long, we have different papers running with the story. Morgan Stanley under criminal investigation by the Department of Justice. We have the new CEO saying at 4 a.m. from Tokyo, "We didn't know. This is news to us." And the stock opening up broadly down the next morning. So I started an article called last week. It was Goldman Whack-a-Mole. Now it's Morgan Stanley whack-a-mole. Interestingly enough, what we're seeing is the Department of Justice bring enforcement actions, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, all firms leading in the manipulation and management of the precious metals price. So a very interesting development, particularly given what's going on in the precious metals market at the same time. I just want to bring us home to the United States. You keep hearing me talk about what's going to happen this summer with state and local layoffs and budget balancing. The federal government can print money unless the states create their own state banks and own script and literally break from the Federal Reserve System. They have to balance their budgets. We see California preparing, according to their governor, Schwarzenegger, to institute unbelievably draconian cuts, literally throwing people off of welfare. Where will they go? And you're talking about cuts that spiral down because literally what they do is they force businesses to close, they force people off their payrolls, As a result, economic activity dies. As a result, state revenues drop, and you can literally see the state losing next year more money than it saved in expenses this year. So it's a very serious situation, and this will be a very long, hot summer. And the thing to understand about Greece is that it's coming here, and it will be here this summer. For many people in the country, it's been here for a while. So with that, let's talk about the precious metals market. Franklin, are you with us?
I'm right here.
Okay, so while the Department of Justice is whack-a-moling all the people who were suppressing the price, and the stock market is playing bungee rope, down 1,000 points last Thursday, and the TVs have everybody terrified with, could this happen here? What, pray tell, was happening with precious metals?
Well, it's very interesting, and the point of government intervention comes in a little later in the story, but last week there was a day, oddly enough, gold was doing very well. Gold had broken through resistance at 1160, which was very, very important technical, a very important technical milestone. And suddenly, for no apparent reason, it wasn't even options expiration day or anything like that, silver dropped a dollar in one day. I mean, just from 1850, it was right there moving along with gold and confirming everything gold was doing. They were moving together the way they ought to, and all of a sudden, wham, down a dollar in one day. And I think that was Wednesday. Then you got the crazy stock market thing. And then on Friday, I saw something that in 30 years of trading silver and gold, I've never seen in my entire career. And that was in 20 minutes, literally, silver rose a dollar, over a dollar. As a matter of fact, it was about $1.04. And I couldn't figure out what had happened. The next day I found out what happened was the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, probably under the pressure of all these revelations about J.P. Morgan manipulating the silver market, made an announcement at 11 o'clock that trade limits, that is position limits, and a position limit is, say, there's a rule in the market on the COMEX that you can't own more than, say, 1,000 contracts of silver. I don't know that that is the position limit, but that's basically what it does. It limits the amount of contracts, it limits the amount of silver or gold that you can buy or sell. Or you can be long or short, as it were. So anyway, they made this announcement. Hey, position limits are enforced during the day, not just at the end of the day. In 20 minutes, the roaches, over-short roaches that were shorting the market, fled for the woodwork. And literally, they got out at any price. I mean,
now,
that's
let's
the only
look
way.
At the time of that. That was
It began exactly at the time of the announcement. So it ran in 20 minutes, literally. But as soon as that news hit the floor, all of those people who were over limit must have liquidated because there was a flood. It was obviously a flood of buy orders all at once, and we know that the over limit people had been short because if they had been long, it would have gone the other way. So within 20 minutes, that had been done. Now there were a lot of the same sort of positions in gold because gold jumped too, but gold did not jump anything like silver, which explains to me at least, or is evidence to me that we've been right all these years.
But the vast majority of the short position in the silver market,
mm-hmm,
is J.P. Morgan Chase. And all weekend long, you have the New York Post leaking that the Department of Justice is investigating J.P. Morgan Chase, but no other papers come out to say the same thing. Is that just a message to J.P. Morgan Chase that they better go along with this?
Well, I don't know. You're better at interpreting that stuff than I am. But there's no question that somebody used the CFTC to send a message probably to J.P. Morgan, because one of the ways that they were accelerating and leveraging the effect of their actions was they would leak the proposed or the planned manipulation to other traders.
Right.
Well, what that means is, let's say you got $1 billion to trade, okay? And you may be the biggest trader around, but $1 billion is just $1 billion. But if you can hook everybody else in there, you can put another $5 or $10 billion on your side.
Right.
So that's the reason why they had done that. Well, I think the message went out, cool it, boys, you can't do this anymore. You're going to have to find another way of doing things. Because it was just, I've never seen anything like it. But as I said, what it is proof that there were huge, huge short positions in the market, over limit positions, and these people were operating right out there in the open. They didn't care. They didn't care who saw them. They had the impression, at least among themselves, that they had official cover.
Well, you're seeing, I mean, at this point, you're seeing a political war, and it's being played with criminal threat, you know, criminal investigations. Now, a criminal investigation complaint can put a company out of business. So,
it can also put somebody in jail.
Right.
and nobody wants to go to jail.
And you're talking about a pretty vicious war. And yet, if you look at both Wall Street and Washington, neither side is standing down. They just seem to be escalating at each other.
Well, I think you've got different factions. You know, you mentioned earlier Peter G. Peterson's, I don't know if he calls it the Peterson Foundation, but he also founded the Concord Coalition. And Peterson, for 15 years, has been warning about the disaster coming in government entitlements. And I think he represents that wing of the establishment that would echo Bill Clinton's sentiments from that video, namely, you've pushed the economy in too unproductive a direction, in the direction of speculation and financial trafficking, and you can't do that because eventually
the tapeworm will kill the host.
Tapeworm will kill the host. That's exactly
But if you look at what they're doing, believe it or not, away from the article we wrote on the ETFs, the precious disclosure in the precious metals puzzle palace, the second biggest hit getter this week at our blog was an article about the 1099 change slipped into the Health Care Act. And you have literally now companies, including small business, are going to be required to give a 1099 to every corporate recipient of over $600. Now, you're talking about something that could bury a lot of small businesses. I mean,
well, the expense of that. Just think about the accounting expense of that.
Well, the accounting expense is extraordinary. I'll tell you what the big expense is. First of all, you got to get correct data to, you know, comply from everybody. All you need to do is have 1 to 5% of 1099s have an error, and you've got yourself an administrative mess that's going to take months to clean up. I mean, it's a nightmare. So you look at that and you say, are they absolutely trying to shut down all small business? I mean, I can't, you know, it's reached that point where, you know, the war on small business is breathtaking.
Well, I know you've heard me say all regulation aims to restrain trade. All regulation. I don't care if the excuse for it is, you know, health or, you know, keeping people from getting tuberculosis, whatever it is, all regulation aims at restraining trade.
Right.
And usually the regulators are in the hands of the biggest corporations. I mean, that's been the beginning. It's been that way since the FDA, for heaven's sakes. So, obviously, I think there's something to what you say. I mean, I think there's much substance in what you're saying. They're trying to put small businesses out of business because you know as well as I do that they don't have that kind of accounting system, whereas the large corporations do.
Right. Yeah. Well, tell me, are you, you know, I believe we're coming into a real tipping point. So given what you've seen in the markets this week, Franklin, is that what the markets are saying to you?
Well, I saw a milestone, and a very significant milestone. Since the beginning of this bull market, I have thought that at some point the metal, silver and gold, would decouple from paper. In other words, when we started back in the 90s, before the bull market started, silver and gold pretty much moved in response to changes in the dollar's value. So they were the slaves, so to speak, of fiat currencies. But what happened this week, when you saw stocks crash, gold dropped just a little bit, not a technically significant amount, and the dollar dropped, then the dollar rise and gold rise with it while stocks tanked. Now, and you're also seeing the euro really in a position really ready to fly apart.
Right.
That's the reason the panic has occurred. It's not because of the Greeks and the bailouts. The real panic is the bailout signifies that the euro might blow apart. So
right, we have the very banks are being bailed out shorting the euro and we're receiving the money.
Right, exactly, which goes to show, you know, that there's some rats that'll even stay with the Titanic if they think they can get something else to eat. But anyway, what I'm seeing is the decoupling of gold and silver from paper monies. I mean, gold functioned more or every bit as much, and silver did too, as a refuge currency, a refuge money, as the dollar did. Because otherwise, why did the gold keep going up? Why do I keep getting reports of shortages, and have been for a week and a half, 2 weeks, of gold shortages in Europe? I mean, I have one of the retailers that I deal with in particular does a lot of business with Europe. He can't get anything out of Europe. He can't get anything out of Europe because they're all sold out.
Well, the other thing is the Europeans have lived through World War II, and you have a generation still alive who remembers that the reason their family was okay was because they had gold and silver.
Listen, I had a particular in both a Hungarian customer and a Jewish customer, both of whom, one of whom had gotten out of Austria because his uncle, over his father's objection, had started a Swiss bank account and had bought gold in Switzerland.
Right.
And then I had another one who was about 10 or 12 years old at the end of World War II, and he and his family lived in Budapest, and their house had been bombed out. He and his father one night crept back into the house, were digging around in the basement, and he said, when I heard the shovel hit the metal box that had the gold coins in it, I knew we'd be okay. So
right.
You're right. Those people, see, all of those stories are still there, and they remember all that.
Right. It's the same in China and India, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
The subcontinent, Asia, and that's, you know, we continue to see a lot of demand there. Another great question we got was John Williams was on last week and talked about the fact that M3 is declining.
Uh-huh.
And the question was, if M3 is declining, so why would gold and silver continue to go up?
Well, there's a good question. There are two possible answers. Jim Turk thinks that they're underreporting M3. He thinks that the actual increase is much, much greater than you can get from the reported statistics. But another reason is what I alluded to earlier, that they don't. It's not the dollar. The gold is not going up in response to the dollar's decline. Gold is going up in response to people's desire for safety.
Right, and it's not just the dollar money system. It's all the money system.
It's all of them. Right.
It's global phenomena.
It's the entire world fiat money system.
Right. The other thing I wanted. There's a wonderful article up on the blog. It links to Robert Landis's article on gold and deflation. It's up at Golden Sexton. He wrote it in 2005. It's one of the best articles I've ever read. And he said, look, this is not about investing for inflation. This is about protecting yourself from the debasement of the currency and lawlessness,
mm-hmm.
and having a form of money that does not depend on government, which is a whole different kettle of fish.
Right.
The other thing I wanted to mention, if you look at the economy in my sort of construct of insiders and outsiders,
mm-hmm.
the M3 of the insiders is going up. Okay? So the insiders have plenty of money and plenty of liquidity. It's the outsiders who are shrinking. And even though they're shrinking, the outsiders are getting more and more afraid. And so you have demand from both groups for different reasons.
Right. Okay. May I recur now to the actual events in the market?
Sure.
Okay. Well, it's so easy to get off on these rabbit trails with you, and they're too much fun to leave. But what we also saw this week in the gold market, first off, let's talk about gold. Gold went to a new high. See, gold went to 1203 in spring of 2008. It went to 1217 in December of 2009. That was the high. That was the high water mark in the market. Well, this week it has not only passed that mark, it blew through it. And I don't know, you know, there are a lot of things that if you watch markets for years and years, you sort of get a feeling of, and I guess it's not really intuition. It's probably just your mind tucking all that stuff away at a level you're not really conscious of. But when a market works its way laboriously up to, say, $1,217, and it labors to get up there and labors to get up there, that means one thing. It especially means one thing after it, when it comes at the end of a long rise. Then, even if you get a jump 1 or 2 days, that looks more like exhaustion than it does continuation. But this didn't move that way. Through great hardship, gold got through the 1160 mark, and then boom, 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 $10, $15, $30 a day, it jumped. And once it got through that old high level, the 1217 close, it didn't just go through it. It went through it $10 before it get it to a stop, and then added another $20, the net $22 the next day. So when you see that kind of activity, that looks more to me, and I have to really bridle my enthusiasm because you understand I'm on the side of gold and silver, and I always, you know, take the most optimistic and enthusiastic outlook. But even bridling my enthusiasm, that looks more like a market that is taking off than a market that's topping.
Right.
And then silver, of course, what silver did was just, you know, in a sense, more fantastic, especially with that dollar reversal that I mentioned. And it's continued to gain, you know, 40 cents a day or more. Now, it backed off a little bit today, but it backed off from where? Silver has also reached, it has not reached the all-time high, which was made in March of 2008 at $20.68, but it's reached the December highs. And it's exceeded those December highs, and it's come to within about 80 cents of that March 2008 peak. This is not far. It's not far to jump. So I think what you're watching are two markets that are they're taking off. They're warming up their engines and they're getting ready to take off. How high can they go? My target for gold is at least $1,375, and my target for silver, well, if we get what I'm thinking, you know, you're looking at something north of $27 an ounce. Now, I know that sounds crazy, but in any event, you'll still get.
If you look at the gold, my target for the year has been 1350. Mm-hmm. If you look at the gold silver ratio coming back into a reasonable place, 27 for silver is very
right.
Does not sound unreasonable.
That's just getting it barely under 50 to 1.
One of the things I did this week was I put the charts up on in this blog post that I put up earlier last year of Nick Laird's chart showing the all-time high on an inflation-adjusted basis.
Yes.
Because one of the questions I know you get and I get is the market's at a high, it's too late, I've missed it, or I should sell and take my profits.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it really helps to understand two things. One is on a historical basis adjusted for CPI, we're not even halfway to the old high.
Right.
The 1980 highs.
Right. That's exactly right.
So on an inflation-adjusted basis, depending on whether you use shadow stats or the government statistics, you know, we're about halfway there or less. The second thing is the reason we want to buy gold and silver is to protect ourselves in a variety of scenarios, including the worst case. And if the worst case happens, whatever the price is going to be, it's going to be a whole different paradigm from the one we're in now. So, for example, Chris Palladgatta is always concerned about the concept of a radical devaluation, and I kept thinking about that when I was watching Bill Clinton talk about getting back to a financial system that was good for a real economy, knowing at the same time the Swiss National Bank had called a meeting in Zurich with the IMF. Because with a radical revaluation, what you do is you go to bed in gold 12 or 1300 and you wake up and it's 2000 or 5000. And that's how they've handled the debt problem. You know, it's they've just marked, you know, they've marked the labor to market in every country globally at the same time.
Right.
So I think to protect yourself in the worst case, it's not even just a function of price. It's what do you have to trade and barter with if your fiat paper should radically lose value quickly.
Well, let me point out another lesson that the market gave us in spades last week, and that is you can't wait until the bullets are flying to buy a pistol.
Right.
You have got to get your positions in place. You've got to do what you're going to do, and then you've got to get out of the way. Think about the stock market, for instance. Suppose you had a position that was just in the Dow stocks, okay? So each one share of that position would have been, 11,000. All of a sudden, it's 1,000 points lower than that, or it's 10,650, and suddenly it's 9,650?
Uh-huh.
In one day?
Right.
And you're going to see that kind of volatility. That kind of volatility is not going to be unusual. So we have to take this lesson to heart. The tendency of the system as it disintegrates, as the tapeworm has consumed more and more of the productive economy, the tendency of the system is to have more frequent crises of greater amplitude.
Right. And that's what we're watching.
Right. And that means more volatility, and that means it calls for a different investment strategy and a different kind of timing. Markets are not predictable enough under those circumstances for you to say, well, I'm going to wait until we reach this certain technical level. You can use some of that, but that has to be tempered by your need to build a position and to get to where you want to be. And it's more valuable to get to where you want to be than it is to hold out for that last penny or so, you know, the last
$8. One of the questions we got this week, at what price would you recommend buying silver presently?
Oh, if you could get it tomorrow or Monday around 1920, even maybe $19. But if you could get it around 1920, I think you'd be doing really well. And gold, if you could get gold around 1230, I think you could be doing well.
Now, we know that summer is a slow time, or I shouldn't say slow, but summer is usually the period when precious metals are the lowest.
Usually.
So the question is could that happen again, or are we really in such a different kind of situation that all bets are off?
Well, you know seasonal trading patterns are averages. So that means that if your chart shows that you have a high that falls in February, that means the high could come anywhere from the first part of January to the end of April. They're averages. And they don't always hold true. What I think we've gone into now is a market like it's taken longer to unroll than I expected, but it's a lot like the advance that we saw that began in August of 2007. It went up into September. There was a stumble into December. There was a stumble in December where the market kind of went sideways for a little while. And then it took off again and went up to way up to new highs, both silver and gold, in March of 2008. So I think what's happened here is coming up off of that, the low out of fall of 2000, you had the market moving up, and then you had a peak of that move that came in December, but that wasn't the final peak. That was just the beginning. That was a correction and beginning of something that has extended now or is extending now. I don't know how long it'll run. Maybe it'll only run till the first week in June. Maybe not even that long. If it does, it'll be very fast and it'll go, I mean, it'll rise very, very fast.
Right.
But there's nothing to say that gold and silver cannot rise in the summer. There's the seasonal pattern against it, but a seasonal pattern is certainly not written in stone.
Well, it's fair to say if you need your core position, you need to get that taken care of.
Oh, yeah.
And then if you're adding incrementally and want to be opportunistic, maybe the summer will have opportunity, maybe it won't. It's hard to tell because we, you know, one of the things that happens to me as an investment advisor a lot, Franklin, is I hear, you hear the investment advisors who say, look, portfolio strategy takes into account everything that could possibly happen and how things have worked through history. And if you just have a balanced account in these different corporate and government securities, it incorporates all that and you don't have to worry about any of that stuff. And I always feel like saying, listen, tell that to the people who are living in Poland in September of 1939.
That's exactly right, when everything's going to change. That's
right.
Exactly right.
Right. We have a series of questions about IRAs, but first I want to go through, again, the different ways that somebody can buy precious metals. Very simply, first and foremost, they can just buy coins and hold them. We did a frequently asked question that is in your Money Changer library for available for all subscribers in the archives. But I think it's fair to say that you and I, our preference is that people buy coins and buy precious metals and hold them in their possession and their control.
Absolutely.
Okay, so it's yours, you control it, it's not in anybody else's hands, you're not dependent on anybody else to be trustworthy, and it's portable.
Right.
You know, if you got to get up and go, you can get up and take it with you. After that, there are a whole series of different arrangements with depositories. One that you and I trust is goldmoney.com, James Turk's company in the UK. And you can hold in a series of different places, including Switzerland and the UK. Another is to put it in a depository, and there are a variety of different organizations that can help you do that. The big depository in this country is Delaware Depository. That's the one that gets used for most of the self-directed IRAs. And you can hold it in a safe deposit box in a bank, and then the question comes down to when the nice government men say, okay, you know, we've got to confiscate the gold, then presumably the Delaware Depository and those banks are going to obey the law. Is that your take on those?
Well, if you know what happened in 1934, and again, I'm not much on the idea that the government will confiscate gold, but if you remember what happened in 1934, they supposedly issued a presidential decree that everyone was supposed to turn their gold in. But the estimate is that less than 20% turned their gold in.
Right.
What gold did they go seize? They went and seized the gold in the banks.
Right.
The easy pickings is what they went for. So for that reason, I wouldn't be wanting to hold gold in a depository.
Right. And there are arrangements you can make around the world. The problem is that increasingly all those countries have relationships with U.S. enforcement. And so if the law changes and applies to foreign banks, then it's going to apply there as well. We know we have foreign financial institution filings. There's a great post up on the blog about those. And essentially, if you've got gold sitting in a vault in a foreign bank, you're going to have to report it in the foreign financial institution's holdings. And then finally, you can buy gold through your brokerage account. And we just published last week an article on the two largest precious metals ETFs, GLD and SLV. And my last preference is buying it through the brokerage accounts. But there are, if you're going to buy it through the brokerage system, there are some good, or there are vehicles that are better than others. We've seen, I mentioned in the Puzzle Palace article, we see Central Fund of Canada trading at a premium of 8% to melt value. It's been up as high, I think, as 14% of melt value, while GLD is trading at a discount of 1% to 3% of melt value. So the market is literally, you know, pricing a 10% difference, saying, okay, one is gold and one is something else. And I think it's really important to understand if you're not concerned about the worst case and you just want to trade the gold-silver ratio, then the ETFs are trading vehicles. If you want to own gold, then you've got to buy something like Central Fund or Central Gold Trust or one of the ones. You know, we have the same problem throughout our society, Franklin. you know, we keep assuming that GLD and Central Fund are both gold, and they're not. One is gold, and the other is a bank deposit, unsecured, without federal deposit insurance, priced in gold.
Right.
Just like if you walk into a supermarket, some of the vegetables are food, and some are something else, but they're not food.
Hmm.
We call them both food.
Let me go back and ask a question about something you said about buying gold through your brokerage account. I have known people who tried to buy physical gold through a brokerage account, and you're going after the rabbit down the rabbit hole when you do that with Alice in Wonderland, because I've just heard some of the most astonishing stories, not only about what they were charged, but the entire hierarchy in the brokerage firm acted like you had asked them for a cut of steak off of some animal that lives on Mars.
Right.
I mean, they just couldn't figure it out what you were doing.
Right.
So I would never recommend buying physical gold and silver that way.
Right. Well, and they'll always push you towards the securities. Now, I have a couple questions on IRAs. I have two retirement accounts from my employer. Both are with Fidelity and self-directed brokerage accounts. I cannot withdraw except in the case of hardship. I'm assuming he means he's got a 401k. I can take a maximum of $20,000 in loans. Would it be wise to take the loan and pay down other obligations, such as paying down a home mortgage or building a greenhouse, buying a wood-burning stove to heat home and greenhouse? These are things we plan to do in the future, but are fearful that things will melt down before our home is paid off. A couple more years. We live on 20 acres and would hate to lose it due to some unforeseen dirty trick. Any suggestions, comments?
Yes, all of the above. I would borrow the money to do any of those things with, because the ownership has only two parts, title and control. What you have with an IRA or a 401k is title. You have no control. Or if you do have any control, it's very, very limited. And you certainly don't have the assets in your own hands. So if you can go and borrow $20,000 from your 401k or IRA, you have effectively, without having to pay the tax penalty, you have converted the control of that to back to yourself.
Right. Well, you've also taken the money out of paper and put it in tangible.
Right, exactly. So
the only thing I would underscore is there's a way you can make the greenhouse, design the greenhouse and the stove so they're portable. So if Katrina hits and you have to move, that tangible is more liquid. Anyway, but you and I certainly agree there. Okay. Hi, gang. Outstanding work at Solari. I just retired and have a rollover IRA to manage. Any idea how much time I have before the NGM, that means nice government men, as Franklin calls them, swoop in and force bonds and annuities down my throat? Keep up the great work.
There's some new information on that, and I just got it today. I haven't had a chance to sit down and study it. But it appears that they've already put an embryonic regulation toward that end into the Federal Register. In other words, they've already announced something that would limit your ability to withdraw the entire IRA
you and I talked about. So when it comes time to take a distribution, you don't get a distribution. You get an annuity in that amount.
Well, my native suspicion and logic and the logic of the government situation leads me to think that that's the place they'll go. They won't try to confiscate gold. They'll confiscate your pension funds and your
that's
your
what
IRAs.
We're seeing in Greece. Hmm? That's what we're seeing in Greece. Here's the question, and I often see it different with different people. You have some people who have all their money in IRAs, and they're much more at risk if the government plays those games than if they have only a portion of their funds in the IRA. And the economics of pulling everything out and paying your penalties and your taxes, if you have to pay penalties and taxes, is enormous. Now, with a rollover IRA, you can put that rollover IRA into physical gold and silver. Now, it's at a depository, and we talked about the limitations of that. But there is... You know, you can get it into physical gold and silver.
Well, that's true, but I still think that you need to go back and ask yourself this question. See, what are taxes about? taxes are no longer for raising revenue. You and I know that if you think about it, because they can print all the money they want through the Federal Reserve. They don't need taxes to raise revenue. Already in 1945, Beardsley Rummel, who was then head of the New York Federal Reserve, published in a speech, taxes for revenue are dead. So what is the purpose of taxes? It is social control.
Right.
And social control means controlling all you members of society, like you and me and the person who's asking this question.
You're not doing a very good job with you and me, Franklin.
Well, there are hard cases. But so the point here is you have to ask yourself if your interest and the government's interest are still in the same track. And if they're not in the same track, it's time to get out. The 25% penalty that you pay, now this is just the way I look at it, okay? And I know that I'm going to horrify every CFA in the world and financial advisor and broker, person who works for a stock brokerage firm. But to me, if I had to pay 25% to get control of a part of $100,000, if that meant I could get the other $75,000 under my own exclusive control, I'd do it so fast it'd make your head swim and tear your hair off. I don't want to be in any kind of partnership with the federal government because I know I'm going to lose. So that I understand. I know I've talked to so many people who have the same hang-up. I'm not being disparaging when I say it's a hang-up. I understand they're saying to themselves, wait. Why, I can just wait a few years, and I don't have to pay the 25%. Well, maybe you can, maybe you can't.
Right.
And it's looking increasingly like you can't.
Right. I always tell people this is kind of a gestalt thing, because it's a political question. It's not an economic question.
That's precisely right.
Another great question. In the market this week, my international bond fund did well and countered my loss from a fuel cell and solar fund. And basically what they're describing is something we've seen across the board in many markets, which is when capital has to protect the bond market and monies are being used to protect the banks in the bond market, the equity markets suffer. And we're watching investment and enterprise struggle underneath several things. One is a financial system that doesn't serve the real economy, and most good equities are enterprises that are trying to make the real economy go. And then enterprises struggling with increased lawlessness and uncertainty. If you're a legitimate business trying to raise capital and serve your shareholders and your stock is getting naked, you know, is experiencing naked short selling and all sorts of other dirty tricks, it makes it a nightmare to run a legitimate business. And we've seen literally since for the entire decade, at the beginning of the decade, if you just put your money in gold and silver, you would have done better than most any combination of stocks and equities. And that's a sad commentary because the thing that grows our economy is great equity and great equity investment, great equity returns. And that's, you know, that is the price we pay for having a parasite that's really draining the economy because it's doing it through the debt and through the dirty tricks in the market. I didn't know if you wanted to say anything about that, Franklin.
You're exactly right. The growth is being financed by debt instead of by equity.
And the equities are in essence being skimmed by the debt game.
Right, exactly. But you know, one of the things in relation to this bond fund that I'd like to point out, LIBOR is the London interbank interest rate, and since 1983, LIBOR has been rising. Okay, that is the value of the short-term bonds has been rising. So LIBOR, in effect, has been falling for 40 years because the yield goes inverse to the value of the instrument. So we've reached something like a 37-year peak. It's been rising since 1983. And I've had two people recently point that out to me and say, look, if this is a fall, it's going to be an enormous fall, which means an enormous rise in interest rates.
Right.
You're talking about a 17% yield, going back to a 17% yield from, I don't know what it is today, but it's probably somewhere around 1.5% or 2%. But anyway, so in under those circumstances, your bond funds will be guaranteed tickets of confiscation.
Right.
They will be the worst losers imaginable.
Right, unless they're very short.
Right, unless they're very, very short.
If you're in a short Norwegian, I think you'll be...
You mean where you're rolling them over, where they're rolling over every 3 months or 6 months?
Norway's annual debt service is negative.
Uh-huh.
They have such... Their sovereign wealth fund is many times their outstanding debt.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll be making a fortune. And and although their oil revenues will be down, but if you're in a short Norwegian, I think you'll be looking pretty. We have a couple more questions. We'll handle them next week. Again, thank you so much for the great questions. I just want to take the last 2 minutes to go to our second date. We're Franklin and I are doing a series, or Franklin's doing, I should say, a series on the top 10 dates in the history of precious metals. And tonight is the second. And Franklin, take it away.
Well, I think 1873 in my mind is that date. And the reason
I remember it well.
No, you don't. I'm not even that old. But anyway, in 1873 occurred what's called the crime of 1873, and the United States demonetized silver. They did it by the back door, the typical kind of stuff that we expect today. They passed a new coinage act, and the coinage act simply did not provide for the minting of silver dollars, which meant that, in effect, the money supply would be reduced by about a third or so. And then we see the effects of it. But why is that so important? It's not just the deflationary effect of that. And you see back then the bankers were net bondholders, so they were pursuing a deflationary strategy from 1865 until 1900 or 1913. But the important thing is that without silver in the monetary system, and remember, since mankind has been on this planet and there has been a monetary system, it has always included both silver and gold. And for a long time, it included copper as well. But when the dollar is defined in terms of a paper unit rather than in terms of silver, then all objectiveness has been removed from the system. Because when you have the dollar defined as so many grains of silver or so many grains of gold, exchangeable for so many grains of gold, then the one unit is defined in terms, is valued in terms of the other. But when you have one unit only, a monometallic gold standard, and it's defined in paper, then the government sooner or later is going to devalue the currency sooner
right.
or later. And that's what the crime of 1873 set up in the United States.
There's a great video we sent out with this week's update. It's up on the blog. Ron Paul explaining Greece as a currency crisis and saying, you know, it's coming this way. That's why we need transparency on the Fed. And he's right. Okay, Franklin, thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, coming up next week, more on chemtrails with Clifford Carnicom. We got so many compliments and questions from our first piece on chemtrails, including a lot about health. And Clifford has been the researcher who's for the longest and the deepest, looked into chemtrails. The movie will be his documentary, Aerosol Crimes. It's up on YouTube. We'll post it on the blog. June 3, Expecting Miracles with Crosby and Farms. A wonderful kind. If you think precious metals are going up in prices, wait, you see what's happening to food. And a wonderful story of people triumphing under adversity. It's one of the best stories of the year, and with great lessons for all of us about how to handle economic and hardship and the banksters. So until next week, you're in our prayers. Don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.